Welcome back to the program. Journalism has often been referred to as a first draft of history. But more than that, newspapers, especially tabloids, have traditionally been the narrative, the connective tissue that binds diverse and disparate communities. They've explained community to the newcomers and explained the newcomers to the community at large. Through that local narrative, we witness and try to understand the conflicts and follies of daily life. And from that, we form our own understanding of the world. Tabloids, in short, are the raw material that drive our own op-ed view of the world, a kind of Rosetta Stone for understanding life. This is the context that no one understands better than our guest today, Pete Hamill. My friend, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Marinus, has said that the first rule of reporting is go there. No one has done that more or better than Pete Hamill. Part of a generation that defined newspapermen, he has been the editor of two great tabloids, The Post and The Daily News, the author of over 20 books, and his brilliant memoir, A Drinking Life. It is my pleasure to welcome Pete Hamill back to the program to talk about his latest novel, Tabloid City. Pete Hamill, thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to hear your voice again.
Well, it's good to have you back. You know, while it certainly can be argued that with the migration of newspapers online and all that's changing in the journalism business, that there's still some great journalism that is taking place, the loss of tabloids is something entirely different. Talk a little about that.
Well, you laid out one of the most important things. The way it is a means of stitching together various kinds of people with a common story. The guy in the Bronx can read about what happened to the woman in Brooklyn. The Dodger fan can read about the Yankee fan. The sense that we're all in this, as different as we are from each other, we're all in this kind of city, and I'm talking about any big city,
right?
Together, whether we like it or not. So I think it was a great annealing thing. I'll give you just one example. My father was an immigrant from Belfast, Northern Ireland. He was not really truly an American until he got baseball. And he didn't get baseball from the Federalist Papers or from de Tocqueville. He got it from the Daily News and the Brooklyn Eagle. And once he got it, he was an American. My mother never quite got baseball, but she was as American as he was, and in many ways more so. But the kind of thing that can be taught indirectly, not with great pompous announcements about the importance of everything, but indirectly and low-key, that can come from a tabloid, in no matter what city it's in, is going to be irreplaceable if we lose them.
And the kind of journalism we have today, the kind of information, it's really broader than that, the kind of information we have today is all sort of self-reinforcing. If you're interested in soccer, you're only reading about soccer. If you're interested in any one thing or one particular group, that's what you're fixated on. You don't have that opportunity to be part of that larger community.
Yeah, and that exactly that. The sense of reading a newspaper, a tabloid newspaper in particular, the sense of serendipity that you get wandering through its pages, reading the things you're interested in first, whether it's sports or the latest crime story or whatever, or some kind of big strike that affects everybody. But then there's the little thing on the style page that suggests you really ought to buy your wife this thing for her birthday. It's there, too. And it's a kind of serendipity that resembles very much to me entering a bookstore. You go and you're trying to find the new John Updike, and you leave with Balzac, too. Or you go to a record store, and you're looking for Billie Holiday, and you go home with Gustav Mahler. There's a sense of discovery that comes when the subject matter in the site that you're going to is not stuff that you are particularly interested in, and suddenly it grabs your attention. I hope we don't end up with a lot of tightly focused website journalism sites, journalism websites, all politics or all gossip or all sports. I hope we get at least a few of the big general sites that will attract all kinds of people to the same place.
It is also part of, as you've written about in several different contexts over the years, it is also part of one's self-education, the one in which you learn about the world and become a more educated person.
Yes. And for me, that was the major project that hasn't ended yet. Because I dropped out of high school when I was 16. And 59 years later, I got my diploma from Regis High School because the Jesuits are slow at this kind of stuff. But that sense of playing catch-up ball, of trying to learn something new every day and maybe more than one thing, is what drew me to newspapers in the first place. And I got a life out of that. I probably would have been a big paper reader anyway had I become a lawyer or a policeman or whatever. But I think that sense of being surprised, of coming across something you didn't know until 3 minutes ago, is the kind of thing that I think we all need to make us feel like we're in a place that's dynamic, that also has a past, that also has a history, where acts do have consequences. I think that kind of thing is pervasive in a good newspaper, particularly in the tabloids.
And how does the city benefit from that? How is New York a better place for having had for so long a lively tabloid culture?
I think it made us feel joined in a way that what I always call the alloy of New York was reinforced by what we learned in tabloids. The sense of diversity, the sense of ethnic and religious diversity in which people are really dealing with the same things. There was no big difference among one religion or another or one ethnic group or another. They became New Yorkers by reading these particularly tabloids, which when I was a kid was 2 cents a piece, and whose genius was that you could read them on the subway without doing an act of contortionism to get the big broadsheet bent at a proper angle to be readable. Right. The tabloid was the creature of the subway, so it was read primarily by the kind of people that use the subways, who choose to go under the traffic instead of through it. And who are not afraid of other people. They go in and they have a sense of embrace in the crowded, occasionally nasty circumstances in which they go to work.
I mean, in that sense, the two are very much related because they're not afraid of people because they understand people perhaps better because of the tabloids.
Yeah, and what they notice is people who look different from them, a black man can look at a white man and they're both reading the Daily News. They're interested in essentially the same things. They might read with a different emphasis the same story, depending on their own backgrounds. But they're full of the same information. And I think if we lose that, we're going to lose something that helps anneal people together, put them together into something that's stronger and much more American in a way.
The other thing that they do is that they inherent in them, whether it's in the headlines or in the stories, bring a sense of humor, a sense of irony to the news itself that you don't get in the broadsheets, and that's important for the people that read them to get through the day.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I hadn't thought of it exactly that way, but when you say it, it's absolutely true. One of the great things that the tabloids do is feature amazing headlines. Sometimes they go too far. they're full of puns, which the younger people from immigrant parents don't know the thing that's being punned upon and should be a little bit straighter. And sometimes they go over the top. But I think they give you a sense, exactly as you say, of irony about the world, that the kind of people who think they lead privileged lives are also slipping on banana peels, as they have done historically for 100 years in the cultures like the American culture. So that's exactly one of the points that I would emphasize. And by the way, the best tabloid writing never wrote down to the audience. In the paper I worked on, Murray Kenton was across the room. Nora Ephron worked there. There were people who could have worked almost anywhere else, but they loved the energy and the dynamism of a tabloid, in a way, and the chance to work in the place that would allow them to be read by people that were probably totally surprised and shocked by what they might be writing. And that's a great way to have something vibrant going on in the context of a newspaper.
Talk a little more about that, what it was like writing for these papers, in knowing what the audience was, and as you say, not writing down, I mean, the work you did, people like Kempton, Breslin, that really captured the essence of what you're talking about.
Well, I think since Kempton had a slightly different background from Breslin and I, but we were basically, the reporters and particularly the columnists, who were kind of soloists in the band. They're not the band, but they get up and blow 8 bars and sit down. That we came from them. We weren't living in some isolated suburb or taking limousines to work or anything like that. We were on that subway trying to get to work. That I think they understood, that we understood, that we had empathy for the problems of human beings one at a time, not as some large group, not as left-handed Hungarians or some other great, you know, weird sociological grouping, but as people one at a time. And I think from what people tell me, they miss that kind of journalism in a way already, even though there are still some very good people practicing it.
And in Tabloid City, you take all that we've been talking about as a kind of backdrop for this story that takes place through the tabloids in roughly a 24-hour period.
Right. But what I wanted the novel to be was not simply a lament for the newspaper, certainly not for journalism, because I think journalism will survive in a healthy way, but for the I wanted a novel that had the same energy and diversity as a tabloid itself, that the kinds of people who appear in tabloids, whose lives you touch very briefly each time you pick up a paper and read through it, that they have a deeper lives than a newspaper can convey, that they have interior lives which no journalist is permitted to speculate about or try to evoke. And I wanted those kind of people in this novel. So although it's about primarily framed by the plight of a paper that's turning into a website, it's also about all those people whose stories we should continue to hear.
People from all, as you alluded to before, people on all sides of the socioeconomic spectrum.
A very rich woman who was killed early on in the novel, a painter who came from Brownsville, had the good fortune to live through the Battle of the Bulge, get the GI Bill, and become the painter he wanted to be. A woman who draws comic books and is up late at night. Some of them have money, some of them don't. There's a Mexican woman who's lost a job cleaning offices in a two paycheck family, which can be calamitous if you have three American children and trying to take two paychecks and make them into something affordable and decent. So there's many more, as you know, but it was that sense and that I have when I walk out the door to don't assume anything. Don't assume that the guy with the flip-flops is impoverished. He might not be. And I don't assume that the guy with the suit and tie and all that is a hedge fund manager. Don't assume anything. People are complicated. And I used to, on the subway, try to imagine the lives of each person I could see on the subway. It was sort of like a writer's workshop, just looking and trying to imagine that 80-year-old woman when she was 12 and in love with some dope that didn't love her back, to try to look at the diversity of the city and not try to blanket out.
The other theme that runs through Tabloid City, and it is something related to what we started talking about in terms of tabloids as a kind of connective tissue, is that no matter how busy, no matter how crowded the streets may be 24/7, that there's a kind of pervasive loneliness that a lot of people feel.
Yes. That's the main emotional thread through the whole book. What happens to the solitary in the most crowded city in the United States? And I try to provide some of the answers. Sometimes solitude can drive people crazy. I have an amateur jihadist in the book, and I was inspired by a quote from the underwear bomber who moaned about his loneliness before he ever started mentioning jihad. There are other people who are consumed by loneliness. It's like a huge hole in their guts. And then there's others who embrace solitude, who find it warm and nourishing. And there are characters like that in the book. The woman herself who was murdered understood that as long as there were books on the shelf, she was never alone. She might be physically alone, but she didn't have any of the isolation that comes from being alone, can come from being alone. So that's very perceptive, Jeff, that was the thing I wanted to do without turning it into an essay. I wanted that sense of the solitary moving through a crowded city and what it means to us.
And as you ride those subways and look around the city, is the diversity still the same for you? Do you still look at it in the same way today as you did, say, 30, 40 years ago?
You know, it depends on the decade. I mean, things have, you know, there was a time when we had run out of the immigrant stream. And when they came back in the 70s, they began to help change the city for the better again. So there were different sort of looks and feels in the subway. But I think it's as diverse today. I get on the subway going downtown, and there's, you know, working people. There's people with bridgemen's boots and helmets, and there's three stockbrokers yammering away at the end of the car waiting to get off at Wall Street. So I think the class diversity is amazing. It's not that people ride the subway as if they're slumming. They want to get somewhere fast by going under the traffic instead of getting stuck in it. So I find it, and a lot of students, by the way, more students than I remember when I was a kid, and the students are all reading. Now, there's a lot of people reading iPads, various devices. I can't imagine some of the guys that I see sitting there are reading Madame Bovary, but they're reading.
Right.
And I hope they move on to read something even better as they grow up a little.
Pete Hamill, his new novel is Tabloid City. Pete, it is always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Jeff.